Here we go.
Got it. Okay.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back once again to the Great Scott Podcast. I am joined by Jonathan Taylor. How's it going, Jonathan?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Now, I know I just asked you this question, but you're in New York and
New York City.
New York City. How are things going in New York for you?
Pretty well, all things considered. It's been like everything else, kind of a rough journey at times, but I was born in New York. I love New York. The dirt, the grime, the cold, it just makes it New York.
Do you go to the ball drop every New Year's Eve?
I've actually only been there once in my life, and
Okay.
it's an experience I'm not looking to repeat.
I thought I saw you one year. I pointed. That's Jonathan right there. Hey, Mom, look. Anyways, no, but you have a very fascinating story, Jonathan, and I was actually reading about it. And my first question was to you before we get to the story,
Sure.
what made you go public with it, and how has life been for you ever since?
So it's a good question. What made me go public with it? I think it was really a combination of things. Part of it was the 3.5 years I spent in a low security federal prison. It taught me a lot about myself. And one of the things I decided is we all make bad choices in life. We all make mistakes. What I did to end up in prison were a series of incredibly stupid and bad choices. They weren't mistakes. They certainly crossed that threshold. But I decided that I'm tired of running. I'm tired of, pretending to be something you're not. So, for instance, I just left a meeting with a group of lawyers, and I said, guys, if my history is uncomfortable, I don't want my stink on anyone unless they're aware of it. And it's kind of a funny thing because ever since, I've looked at this and been honest with other people and honest with myself, and chose to not advertise, but not run away from it either. Things have been going very well in a number of aspects.
And people seem to love it when you take ownership of your stink, as you called it. Yeah.
There's a lot of that.
There's definitely a lot of that. And so now to get to the story.
Yeah.
You were in prison for three and a half years, you said?
3.5 years,
Three and a
yeah.
half years, yeah. For human trafficking, or what the
Correct.
government thought was human trafficking, because it's a broad spectrum of stuff.
Wow, it certainly is. It certainly is. It's most people think of human trafficking as, you forcing like children into some sort of a shipping container at gunpoint and selling them overseas, the horrible, horrible things. And that is part of it. That's the worst of it. That wasn't me, but I certainly unknowingly contributed to some really, really bad stuff. And I was using a lot of cocaine, running around, behaving like a selfish, spoiled jackass in a very conservative district, and actually a place of the country I really love because I'm actually an avid cave diver. It was a series of things, and I was indicted. And we were really thinking about going to trial for a long time. And at the end of it, I just said, we just gotta plead this out. I've got to take responsibility. I've got to take ownership. My lawyers at the time said I had a very triable case. But funny thing, the night before the feds hit my front door in my house, which is a heck of an experience, I was lying in bed and I was looking up at the ceiling and I said, something's got to change. I've lost the ability to control myself and my drug use and alcohol and the lifestyle. I was completely out of control. And literally the next day, things changed with the knock from the FBI.
Oh yeah, I bet. Yeah.
It was a heck of a thing.
But do you see this, and this might be an interesting question, maybe someone hasn't asked you this, but would you say this is a blessing in disguise when you said something has to change?
Yes, no question. It really was. Obviously, going through the process, I was of course angry. I felt that I wasn't being treated fairly, and it turns out I think the Justice Department actually did treat me fairly. I think they treated me fairly, all things considered. Nobody wants to go to prison. I certainly wouldn't recommend it. That's one hotel that always has a reservation for you. And I'll tell you, it's a rough experience, but I actually miss some of the elements of that experience and some of the relationships that I've made
When you speak of
as a result of it.
the relationships you made before getting into that, I just want to say my dad taught the gospel to prisoners for 30 years. He had his own weekly
Really?
Bible study, and he first week he applied for it, the application, and he said, what would you want to be known as? Reverend, doctor, whatever. And the last one was medicine man.
That's pretty funny.
So yeah, my dad
Medicine.
did that until COVID pretty much killed that. And but anyways, so the relationship you're, well, before we get to that, there's something else I
Sure.
want to ask you. How did you manage to get involved in drugs, alcohol, and how did you get involved in all this?
At a fairly young age, believe it or not, I was introduced to cocaine by a family member of mine, a cousin, at a young age, around senior year of high school, in that time frame. And I had been using it on and off ever since. And it really does kind of change you. Obviously, there's scientific evidence of it altering your chemistry, your brain chemistry, and the way you react and think. But it really does change your view of the world, and it compromises yourself in a way that you're willing to do things you would normally never do. And I view the problem of drugs, alcohol, women, all of these things, like prostitution, all of these things are related. You can't isolate these problems. You really have to step back from it and look at the entire problem in its entirety. And I think that's one of the things that a law enforcement is beginning to see when they combat these problems.
There's still problems with our justice system, but it seems like that they want you to get out of there as fast as can as you can, get out of prison. But anyways, so you talked about the relationships. I know this is like the third time I mentioned that, but you met a very nice clergyman yourself while in prison.
Sure, sure.
You talked about David Wax is his name,
Yes.
and he was a rabbi.
Yep.
And did you convert or did you become Jewish?
Well, I've always been a Jew, so
Oh, you've always been a Jew.
that's
Okay.
never been an issue, but it's amazing what you don't know. Rabbi Wax is just an amazing, amazing guy. He was in prison for what some people might consider the right reasons, where I was clearly in prison for the wrong reasons. His case is interesting. But he was a guy, he was incredibly patient, incredibly passionate, and he knew how to listen in a way that most of us don't. So he knew I was hurt, he knew I was struggling, and he developed that. I can't talk to him today, but I do have religious leaders that have passed messages to him. Right now, while I'm on supervised release, I can't knowingly talk to a convicted felon without
Oh,
permission.
sure. Yeah.
So my understanding is that he's doing well, and I look forward to the day I can talk to him.
You guys write each other at least? I mean, are you able to write each other?
I don't know the answer to that question. I haven't. I wrote him a letter a while ago while I was still in, which I know he received.
Okay. And you're also, you said, an active cave diver.
Yeah.
How was it that cave diving, was that after you got released that you?
No. So So I was born in New York, raised on Long Island and New York City. I started scuba diving at the age of 8 years old. I actually had a babysitter whose older brother was a diver, and he made money by cleaning boat bottoms. And he taught me how to dive when I was 8 years old. And I was addicted to it. It's an addiction I still have. God, the amount of dive gear I have is insane. And so I started getting into technical diving in the late 80s as a teenager. I was diving shipwrecks off of Long Island. And then in the early 90s, we wanted to explore caves, got some cave training, went back to shipwreck diving. And then in 2012, a good friend of mine named Dan said, "Hey, let's go to Florida and do this right." And I've been cave diving ever since, or except my vacation.
How do you not get yourself stuck inside of caves? Because I'm assuming
So,
yeah.
yeah. So it's all about the training, and
Yeah.
it's all about knowing your limits. And believe it or not, emotional control over yourself is so important in a tough situation, which I've had a couple underwater. And you know, you're underwater, you're in a very unforgiving environment. I was pinned by a group of lockers in a deep submarine off of New Jersey in 230 feet of water. And I had to wiggle out of that. That was the first real close call I had underwater. More recently, I was pinned by some sliding debris in a cave in 325 feet of water. That was rough. That certainly shook me to my core.
Wow.
And but your training is everything, and surrounding yourself with good people, it's just like life, will go a long way in cave diving.
Now, have you found any like doing these dives? Have you found like any lost treasure or anything interesting that?
No, you know, I'm really not interested in artifacts or treasure. I
Okay.
just love the water. I love being in the water. Right now, my friend Dan organized, he's doing some work for the police. I'm a part of the dive team. We're trying to find the body of Robin Murphy, who is believed to be in a quarry upstate New York. She was raped and murdered at the age of 17. So we've been looking for that body for years, and it's an extremely dangerous dive. It's a mine, so the cave environment is there. It's also extremely deep and cold. It's deeper than 400 feet, and the water temperature at the bottom is 39 degrees, so it's life-threatening. One of our divers actually died a couple of years ago looking for the body.
Wow. Yeah, I see people. I know that they're in ships, but I mean, I see people like dive down to look at the Titanic. I know that's like 2000, no, like
Yeah,
more than that, but
that's rough, and we're obviously aware of the tragedy that recently ensued, and
yeah.
it was a tragedy that was totally unnecessary.
That's my thing too. And I just kind of wanted to get your opinion on that when you once I found out you're a diver. But do you
Yeah,
feel that that trip should have ever happened in the first place?
I think it should never have happened. You know, first of all, using carbon fiber in that application is the absolute wrong thing to do. It's just not the right material. I have some carbon fiber tanks that are obscenely expensive, and that contains a huge volume of gas under pressure. But when you're trying to keep pressure out, it's the wrong material. It's far too brittle. There are too many things that can go wrong. There was a scooter manufacturer, they made underwater propulsion vehicles that chose to use a carbon fiber hull, and they've had problems with instant catastrophic failures. So for a sub, and I think if I'm not mistaken, James Cameron pointed this out, and he does his own work, and he nailed it. It's just the wrong material.
I think the guy who made it said he made it down there once with carbon fiber before, and I guess he wanted to test it again since he got lucky once, I guess.
It's amazing how that works. tried and true methods exist for a reason. Trying to reinvent the wheel has certainly led to a lot of problems.
Yes, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah.
Yes. And so lesson here is don't try to reinvent the wheel.
Exactly. It works. The one we have works real well.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for your time, buddy. It's been a
Of
pleasure to
course.
talk to you. Thank you
My
so much
pleasure.
for your story.
My pleasure.
Take care of yourself.
All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.